Please mind the gap between the train and the platform. This is Hounslow West. This is a Piccadilly line service to Cockfosters.
Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, recorded in Russia and edited, as you probably guessed from our intro, in London. This week's show is brought to you by RSA Security. RSA's Greg Singh will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk smart card authentication, and it is an interesting chat. For those groovy digital native Web 2.0 enabled Gen Y types out there, I'm now on Twitter at twitter.com/riskybusiness. Now, before we get stuck into the show, we have an announcement. This week, regular guest and KiwiCon organiser Adam Boileau is now a big daddy. Lucy Barbara, £9.3, born on the afternoon of July 1. So there you go. Congratulations, Adam, on your start of financial year, baby. This week's edition of Risky Business is a bit different. Kaspersky Antivirus, the Russian company, flew three Australian journalists to St. Petersburg in Russia for its partner conference, and I was lucky enough to be one of them. Yay me. For Kaspersky, it was a good way to cozy up to the press and hopefully generate a bit of coverage, and boy, did they pay for the privilege. No expense was spared on us. For starters, all Australian journalists flew here in business class, and that was just the beginning. Kaspersky's conference was the most lavish IT junket you can imagine. It even included a fancy dress ball at a stunning old cathedral. Everyone was given costumes that cost 2,000 euros each. We had to give them back, unfortunately, but, you know, you're getting the idea. The cost of the party alone was thought to be in excess of $1 million. We even had an orchestra-backed opera singer performing while we ate, for God's sakes. It was incredible. It's the only million-dollar party I've ever been to, let's put it that way. Now, Kaspersky was showing off for a reason. It plans to go public, to list on the stock exchange, to allow it to sell more easily into the enterprise. Apparently getting, you know, big deals when you're a private company can be a bit tricky. Now, despite being a private company, Kaspersky is already throwing its books open and releasing its financial results. It wants the world to know it's strong, which is, you know, I guess why they flew us over there. But I was there to talk tech stuff, and as you know, lately there's been considerable talk about the lack of effectiveness of signature-based antivirus software. In its early days, antivirus software was little more than a blacklist of known badware, because, you know, let's face it, there wasn't much of it back then. But times have changed and threats have evolved, and for the most part, antivirus companies really failed to innovate. But today, antivirus companies are keeping their blacklists, but focusing more on old-school host-based protection measures as well. It's times like this you have to consider that the antivirus industry and security industry are finally converging properly. I know, you know, companies like Symantec have always said that's the case, but it's not. So yeah, that fusion seems to really be taking place, and that's the impression you get when you speak to Kaspersky's analysts. Now, the AV guys of old, finally they're realising that using blacklists as a first line of defence is no longer acceptable. It's a view espoused also by Dave DeWalt, the CEO of McAfee. He recently expressed his shock at the growth in malware and said whitelisting had a lot of promise as an architecture. The proliferation of malware over the last 2 years has indeed been shocking. At the end of 2007, 40% of all malware was actually created in that year alone, which is just a stunning statistic. At OSCERT's security conference on the Gold Coast in May, Cisco CSO John Stewart joined in the chorus of high-profile security figures to declare signature antivirus dead as a first line of defence. But back to Russia. One thing that makes Kaspersky Antivirus different to others is it's still run by its founder, Eugene Kaspersky. He's a bit like a Russian Richard Branson type. He's charismatic, he's intelligent, and he does love a beer. At one point during the conference, I planned to stay back at the hotel because I was jet-lagged, and he just wouldn't let me. He's this Russian millionaire buying me beer and sort of cajoling me into coming out. He's one of those call me Eugene type of entrepreneurs, and everybody in the company loves him. Now, Kaspersky himself knows that enterprise anti-malware companies have to move significantly beyond signature-based AV if they are to flourish. In fact, Kaspersky Antivirus, along with its competitor McAfee, have licensed whitelisting technology from whitelisting company Bit9. But Eugene refuses to accept that whitelisting is a viable solution on its own.
Our vision is that the modern antivirus, modern anti-malware system have to be very complicated. They have to get more and more protection technologies into the same solution. So we are focused on that, and this is our way, our strategy of our product development, to develop better, to develop more and better technologies and more and better approaches how to stop badware.
You say that the antivirus of the future has to be very complicated, but surely we could come up with an extremely simple model based on whitelisting, assuming that enough resources were thrown at determining what is good and what is bad.
Let me talk about the problem of whitelist or blacklist from the point of view of the customer. If the customer is the enterprise, which has very strict rules on their applications which are allowed to run in the enterprise network, very strict rules and regulations for employees, I think the whitelist is, it can survive as itself, as a poor whitelist application, because the employees, anyway, they are not allowed to run any extra applications. So in this case, the enterprises, they can collect the data about their clean files, about the files which are allowed to run in the system.
Sort of part of setting up their standard operating environment.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Some of the standard environment. But if you talk about consumers or small businesses,
they want their Dancing Bears screensaver.
Exactly. They want to run any application they are receiving.
But surely, if you had, 300 people working for a year on scouring the internet and finding every single conceivable application and putting as much time into testing that to see if it was good as you spend looking at malware samples to see if they're bad, surely you could create a whitelist that is comprehensive enough. There's more badware than goodware.
I'm not sure. Is it more goodware or badware in the world? I'm not sure, and I'm not sure what's easier, to collect all the badware or collect all the goodware. I'm not sure, so I don't want to say that we have to go this way or this way. I think that we have to combine both technologies into the same product, and actually what we do. And this is one part of the problem, that is very difficult to collect, and I think it's almost impossible to collect all the applications around the globe. And second problem is that not all the badware is application. What about infected Office documents, Trojan scripts? For example,
well, things that don't even actually have to execute, I suppose, if they're script-driven.
Yeah. They're just scripting. Yeah. Just script systems. For example, one of their most popular Trojans for smartphones, they send SMS to paid numbers. It's just a JavaScript. Mm. That's all. So they're to collect all their good applications and to deliver the database about all these good applications, I think is a more complicated task than to collect the data about all the badware and develop their protection. Example, in case of their whitelisting, we have to collect the data about all the variants of their goodware. So we have to have a screenshot, fingerprint of all their, every variant, every...
I thought versioning would be complicated. It would mean that the developers of this application would have to get an approved hash through every single anti-malware provider.
Yeah. So it's a huge database of the files. And for example, to prove my words, in case of our blacklist technologies, we deliver databases to our customer, to the endpoint. In case of whitelist checking, we send the snapshot of the file to our server, because the database of the clean file is so huge, so that's cheaper to send the data about the file to our remote server than to deploy to the database to our customer. And a second thing is that in case of their badware, we can detect it by families. So we don't release the signature for every variant of the badware.
You can identify a particular behavior.
Yes, the skeleton. Just to detect the skeleton, just to detect the sister and brothers. Mm. Then we do it. Most of our Most of our protection is based on this one because there are a number of new malware samples that's counted by millions, and new signatures which we release is counted by 100,000. So it's times less because we have these special technologies how to decrease the size of our blacklist databases. If we talk about whitelist, we have to be absolutely sure that this is exactly this file. So we have to have their hash, their MD5 usually, for every single variant of this software. So if there is a Chinese company which develops their, say, some screensaver or browser helper object, and they develop several variants a day, we have to add the hash for every single variant of the Trojan. Multiply this number on the thousands of the software companies in China. So I think that to develop the security which is based on the blacklist, on their high quality, high-end blacklist, is better than the security based on the high-end whitelist, because it's easier to develop blacklist technologies.
Kaspersky Antivirus founder and CEO Eugene Kaspersky there. Magnus Kalkuhl is a virus analyst with Kaspersky's lab division in Germany, and he freely admits that it's time to get away from signature-based AV as a first line of defense. And he has a nice, simple explanation of the history of the AV business.
Let's go back a couple of years, like 10, 15 years. Then you had a big number of clean, trusted programs, and you had just a small number of malicious programs. So what people did, what AV companies did, was just to make a small list of these bad programs, and that's blacklisting. Finally, it turned out that's not enough. So new malware was released faster and faster. So we came up with heuristics, with proactive technologies that try to guess if it's a virus or not, even if there is no signature available. Problem to that solution is that, of course,
it doesn't work.
Well, it depends. So it's a question of tolerance. So if you set up your heuristics very aggressive, to an aggressive level, it will detect almost all malware, but you will get false positives on and on and on. And so if you lower the level of aggressiveness, less malware will be detected and almost no false positives. So this is always a very difficult game. And whitelisting is an interesting approach because then you can have the best of both worlds. So you can have a high aggressiveness of your heuristics, and the whitelisting is there to help the user if a false positive comes up, so to prevent this.
So you don't see whitelisting as being an exclusive sort of solution, but it's something that allows you to really turn up the heuristics component of a full suite.
Right, so there has been a discussion ongoing, especially during the last month. So some companies are saying blacklisting is dead and whitelisting is the thing. And we think that's just stupid because people want to know the names of their viruses. It's not only that they want to know this program is harmless, they also want to know this is the virus with this name. So we're just combining the best of both worlds, and so far people are very happy with that.
So you think the fact that they need to be categorized, people can't wrap their head around an unnamed threat? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Yes, people want names. I mean, especially companies want names. If they have a threat in their company, the boss asks them, so what kind of threat do we have? And then it just helps if you say, well, here's a link to the description of this virus and this is the name of it. And there's a reason why we have these names and families, because it helps you, for example, to understand how malware development goes on and goes on.
And I suppose there's another angle to that too, which is that not all viruses are executable files. You know, there's going to be a lot of scripting stuff, and a whitelist won't really help you with a scripting threat, right?
It depends. Of course, you can also whitelist scripts, but you're right, there are areas where it's not possible. So we have this approach in our new product, which is HIP systems, a host intrusion prevention system, where you have a very complex rule set. And if you're someone who does not like complex things, you don't have to care about it because all the rules will be downloaded automatically for every application. You have a rule set. It's allowed to do this, to do that, to touch this file, but not this folder. And if you want to, you can modify it on your own. So you can really sandbox applications.
So, I mean, it is funny, isn't it, that antivirus companies are basically turning into HIPS companies with a little bit of antivirus?
Well, we started to do that kind of process two versions ago, but you're right, now it's becoming more and more important. And, of course, it's an ongoing war between the antivirus company and the malware programmers. So if you look back a couple of years, it was enough for the malware programmer to release like one sample a day, and it was enough for a V company to release one signature update a day. And then the whole business went faster, and now, you know, we're releasing about one signature update per hour. So maybe it's our fault that the malware programmers are now releasing more and more samples.
But it's funny because, you know, antivirus software today looks more like Tripwire on Linux than, you know, the first signature-based scanning stuff that we really saw hitting DOS computers. Do you agree with that?
It has become really, really complex, right? So if you compare it, there's a big difference with the classical signature-based scanner and the thing that we have today. For example, in our version 5, it was just a signature-based scanner. Then we had version 6 with proactive stuff added. And, of course, this was a bit more complicated, and the user suddenly had to think about several things and to understand what this AV software is really doing. And then we had version 7, which was even more complex. And this was the point where we understood, okay, we have to change things. In the new version, we just did a complete redesign. Everything, the whole user interface, the whole logic of using the program was completely redesigned. So if you install it in the, let's call it human mode and not expert mode, it will just run and it will only complain if you really have a severe problem. But you don't have to configure anything or to say, allow this, deny this. This is the way how it should be in an ideal world, of course.
Magnus Kalkul there from Kaspersky Labs in Germany, speaking to me in St. Petersburg. And that wraps up my report from Russia. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Greg Singh from RSA Security. RSA is one of our fabulous long-term sponsors. They have been really, really supportive. And this week we're talking about passwords, two-factor authentication, and smart cards with Greg. It's RSA's kind of bag, after all. And we started by talking about some bad password practices Greg's seen in various organizations.
There's two ways that people generally tend to deal with a password. It's either something that they can write down and they can put somewhere where they can get, only they can get to it. Now, that's usually going to be something like a strong password, and where someone's dictated, they need to have something strong. Now, if indeed it's stuck to their machine, well, that's a pretty bad thing, because anyone can just walk past and get to it, or it's just a bit of paper sitting in their top drawer, which is pretty common. So the other side of that is that you have a very weak password, because the person has to remember it, and no one wants to remember anything too complex. And that's a danger as well. So
They'll also reuse that same password across like 6 million different sites. They'll actually reuse the same password, like a dictionary word, at 10 different locations. And whoever's running one of those sites can then, you know, take a pretty good guess at what their VPN password is.
Yeah, I mean, people tend to do that because people don't want to remember particular site passwords. They'll tend to use, exactly as you said, the same password against a number of different online subscriptions.
Now, we've got two options for dealing with this. Obviously, there's the two-factor authentication solution where you're using a one-time password, whether that's delivered by a token or by SMS. What are some other options for two-factor?
Well, there's always the token, which is either hardware or software, and software means it's actually a bit of code that runs on a device such as like your mobile phone or BlackBerry or something. SMS is what we call on-demand delivery. So you actually say to a portal or something, give me a token now, and it sends it to a predefined mobile phone. But another extension of that is also on-demand email, where it could actually be delivered via email, say to a BlackBerry, or indeed maybe even a Hotmail account or something else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this type of delivery is never going to be quite as secure as actually having something that's discreetly generating it in your hand. But it's still a good method for access to get to systems for people who may not have the requirement to use two-factor on a regular basis. We're talking about, you know, people who might come and touch a site, you know, once or twice a year. Just deliver it to them via SMS. Remove the need for them to carry a bit of hardware or indeed install a bit of software, and make it easier for everybody.
Now, have you been training one-time password pigeons
deliver
them by carrier pigeon? I mean, that'd be pretty secure. You could train them as like ninja pigeons.
And release from the server center with a little bit of paper attached to their leg.
That sounds perfect, you know.
I hope the pigeons are right at the end of it.
No, you destroy the pigeon at the end so that it can't be interrogated later.
Look, there's a lot of things that lead into the password conversation. I mean, there's a number of vulnerabilities that you can find within people's software. Phishing's a big one. People can often have what they think is a strong password, but once it's actually known by someone else, and indeed if it's caught by a phishing attack, you can be very vulnerable to that individual. And even though it might have happened today, the attack may not happen until next week.
Well, this is an interesting thing. There was another presentation at OSCERT actually by Steve Stroud, who's from the Attorney General's Department, and he ran the Cyberstorm sort of war game exercise in Australia. And he saw some really daft behaviour when that happened, like some proposed incident response to, okay, say a keylogger's got out there among our customer base and harvested a bunch of usernames and passwords, so you're going to force a password reset on your entire customer base. Well, that's not very good, is it? Because if they've got keyloggers on their machines, the attacker is going to know the new password as well.
That's right. It just keeps on going around the same circle. And until people actually remove the offending software from their machine, you're not going to solve it.
But the sort
of technology that can get around it, of course, is two-factor authentication. And as part of that, what we're talking about is a one-time password. So even if your password is captured on the way, it's only valid that one time anyway.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm sure all the listeners are very much familiar with the tenets of two-factor authentication. But, you know, I suppose another thing they're familiar with is that these man-in-browser attacks are making, you know, we can see trouble on the horizon as far as tokens go. I mean, do you think we're going to move to a situation? Of course, there's one area that we didn't mention for two-factor authentication, which is things like smart cards and actual physical devices. Do you think they're going to get some traction eventually?
I really do. Yeah. Mm. I really think, I mean, we're seeing more and more traction with PKI and smart card type implementations from the enterprise and also within government that it's really starting to move quite strongly in the market. I really feel that the virtues of PKI have not been fully recognised yet by industry.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of the virtues not being recognised, but the deployment being recognised as being incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's come down to just rumour and what people think is very difficult from a technology that really is not quite as difficult to deploy, anywhere near as difficult to deploy as what people may have thought it has been for whatever reason.
Yeah, I can see very much on the horizon some intelligent stuff happening with smart cards, no pun intended, but it looks like I'm traveling over to Amsterdam in September to go to the Netherlands GovCert conference.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a big focus over there is going to be cards used in transport systems, you know, so off-the-shelf stuff like, you know, smart cards and whatnot used for, what was it called in Sydney? T-card, the original idea, things like that. So, I mean, once you've got an entire city population issued with a standard type of card, a standard form of card, it wouldn't really take that much extra work to use that for other purposes, would it?
No, that's right. In fact, one of the biggest issues in the whole discussion around smart cards is that it is such a strong form of authentication that how do you actually authenticate the person initially to get the card to them?
You've got to be really careful, don't you?
It's just the initial deployment, but the actual technology that sits behind it is really quite straightforward and very understandable.
Well, it's funny too, because the Rudd government, it looks like they're looking into deploying some sort of similar card to the, what did we call it last year, Australia Card 2.
Yep.
I think it was the welfare access card or whatever the hell I called it.
If you want service, you need the card.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You know, if you want to, like, get medical attention and, you know, eat and like get a bank account and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You don't have to have it, but if you want those things, well, you need one.
Yeah. I mean, it was obviously going to turn into a situation like that. But yeah, watch this space. It's going to be interesting. But hang on, going back to passwords for a minute.
Yep.
You know, Cheswick's whole thing, and this doesn't get around keyloggers, but his whole thing around passwords was, why don't we just start locking people out, or at least, you know, doing escalating timeout on a login when someone gets a password wrong? I mean, why are we still allowing brute force attempts in this day and age? And I think he's got a real point there.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to administration and people looking at systems and going, do we want to actually, like, there's only 5 people that actually sit in this area that have the ability to reset a password and deal with the volume coming in. And if we actually up the policy on a public website to say, instead of allowing 10 attempts or 15 attempts, we're going to make it 2, that's going to push the volume through to that workforce quite exponentially.
Oh, and it also presents an opportunity for an attacker to just go through and, you know, do brute forces on not only passwords but username pairs as well, so they can basically sync an entire organization's lockout policy that way, because you know, you really put the power in the hands of the attackers to just completely nuke all of your users' passwords. But, you know, something that, you know, your second login takes 4 seconds before you can do that, your third login 8 seconds, and something that escalates like that and eventually boots you for an hour, that's going to make a brute force attack a lot harder, right?
That's right. Well, I mean, RSA actually introduces some other product to market with, like, the adaptive authentication suite, which is when we actually start to sense some of these things going wrong and possibly from different source addresses, etc., we can start to look at escalating the actual authentication mechanism. So password might be okay for 98% of the population coming through your system, but it might require that we step up to a token or some other form of two-factor authentication for people that we think is a very high-risk transaction.
I remember years and years ago, Westpac would only allow transaction volumes of a certain amount to be processed if you use two-factor, you know? So you were still covered if you didn't have it, but you couldn't. You literally were not allowed to do transactions over, I think it was $4,000 online, unless you actually had a token, which made a lot of sense, really.
That does make a lot of sense, actually. It helps protect not only the individuals, but also the institution. But in the same token, and no pun intended...
Ha, ha, ha. Zing!
It becomes somewhat of an inconvenience to people who actually want to do legitimate business.
Now, look, just before we go, because we are running out of time, you know, there's been a lot of talk about man-in-browser attacks and really about them rendering tokens quite ineffective. On the surface of things, it does sound like it's trouble on the horizon for your standard sort of hardware token. But what do you think, Greg? Do you think that the man-in-browser threat is a tad overhyped, or are you guys already thinking, we might want to move on as a company into more intelligent ways of issuing one-time passwords?
There's always going to be different ways to issue them. I mean, RSA is definitely moving into other areas, as we talked about, email, SMS, and other forms of delivery of one-time passwords out to the user base. But at the end of the day, nothing will actually beat having a piece of discrete hardware in your hand and being able to authenticate to another system with that, and not having to send that token code to the individual over some other form of public space.
So a smart card with a private key on it gets sent some data, scrambles it, you know, signs it, whatever, sends it back and says, yes, I am who I say I am. You reckon that's the future?
I would say that really is the future. I mean, I'm a strong advocate of the PKI technology, and I really feel that this is coming in stronger and stronger all the time, with more and more industry interest in it.
Well, it will be interesting to see if, you know, a smart card reader winds up coming standard on, like, you know, say Dell laptops or something like that. That's when it's going to start getting used, right?
Well, my laptop, which is just under 2 years old, actually has a smart card reader in it. It is a Dell laptop. So a number of them are coming through with it in there. I know most of the fleet that we're using here in corporate at RSA are now coming out with smart card readers. Built.
Oh, well, I knew that. I'm Patrick In Touch Gray, didn't you know? All right, Greg Singh, thank you very much for your time.
Patrick, thank you.
RSA Security's Greg Singh there with this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. I'm taking a week off, so there will be no show next week. Sorry about that, but I will be busy climbing rocks in southern France and stuffing my face with all sorts of cheese. Life's rough, I know. This week's Sound Foundation track is Paid My Dues by Sarah McGregor, and you can buy it on soundfoundation.com.au for $1.40. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. I want you, I need you, I love it when you do what you do. I want you, I need you, I love it.